Okay, so our topic is Ezekiel, who's a priest in exile, and his ministry, as you can tell, since you know your date so well now, 598 was the collapse of Jerusalem. He was taken into exile, along with Jeconiah, the king, and whoever else. And 587 was the destruction of Jerusalem. So the first part of his prophetic scroll was stuff he was saying in exile between the capture of Jerusalem and its destruction. So that gives you the feel of that. And the second part of it, from 587 to 571, so that's a period of 16 years, is material that he said after the destruction. And that gives you a different kind of sense. So let's begin our journey. And it'll take a while for me to introduce all this. I'm beginning with a statement which is not from the Bible. It's from the Babylonian Chronicles, translated from Akkadian into English, but not by me. All right. And this is an external witness to what we're saying. And it reads, in the seventh year, the month of Kislev, and we've worked out, that's from the 18th, halfway through December to halfway through January of 598 to 597. The king of Akkad mustered his troops, that's Babylon, Akkad, marched to the Hatti land, which is their name for Palestine, and encamped against the city of Judah, brackets, Jerusalem, clearly. And on the second day of the month of Adar, which would be March, so the months are worked by the full moon, so it's just after the full moon of March, March the 16th, 597, he seized the city, captured the king, and we know his name is Jehoiakim, which means may Yahweh be established, or establish. That's his throne name. Captured the king, and he appointed there a king of his own choice. And we know from the Bible that's Zedekiah, an uncle of the young man, young king. Received its heavy tribute and sent them to Babylon. So there we are. There's a statement we've got from external history talking about this event, the capture of Jerusalem in 597 BC. So 597, let's get into English now. King Nebuchadrezzar of Babylon captured Jerusalem. King Jehoiakim, the young king, Jeconiah was his actual name, but his throne name is Jehoiakim. The leaders and the artisans were taken as hostages and deported. Jehoiakim retained his kingly status. In fact, he was released while still in exile in 561 BC. He was under house arrest, but every day he went to the king's table and ate quite well. So he was, you'd call him a hostage. But treated quite well. And when the king died, when Nebuchadrezzar died in 561, his son, who took over from him, let him go free. But he stayed in Babylon and died there. Now, the records of the numbers taken into exile at this time vary, which is another interesting thing when you're looking at the Bible. They're doing their best to get it right, and there are different opinions, so they put them both in, I presume. In the second book of Kings 24:14, speaks in general terms of 10,000 being taken into exile in 598. Why I'm telling you this is because Ezekiel's one of them, we know that. Now, in the second book of Kings, 24, verse 16, two verses later, it says there were 7,000 plus 1,000 craftsmen. So clearly they didn't know or didn't have the record straight, so they put them both in because they didn't want the truth to be lost and they weren't sure what it was. Fair enough. Jeremiah, in 52:28 of the prophecy of Jeremiah, speaks of 3,023 Judeans. That's what he says, and the scholars think, well, maybe he's just telling us how many there were from Judah, excluding Jerusalem. they're trying to work out the number differences why they'd be there. So how many people got exiled into Babylon, I don't know. But the figure is something like 8, 9, 10,000. We're not talking about a small group. There's a map there for you, and you know it pretty well already, I guess. You can see where Jerusalem is over there, and that's Babylon there on the Euphrates River. So they're not that far apart, except you have to go north and then south again. You have to go along the what's called the Fertile Crescent, because they can't cross the desert. But that's where they are. So the Babylonian exile, this is now key, demanded an enormous religious adjustment. In spite of all the hopes, try and put yourself into the situation, in spite of all the hopes built upon promises understood to have come from God, so that gives them, that's pretty big, the promised land had been taken from them. The land that God gave them. What's going on? Despite the assurances that they had been given that Jerusalem would not be defeated by a foreign king, assurances that were reinforced when Sennacherib failed to capture the city in 701, and I might remind you of that, Sennacherib, that's the Assyrians, took Samaria, destroyed most of Judah, besieged Jerusalem, this is in 701 at the end of Isaiah's period, but withdrew. And there's different opinions on why they withdrew in the Bible itself. There's three. I won't give them all to you again. The most probable one is that the king, who, when they took Lachish, which is just down south, sued for peace. And then they said, in other words, he didn't defend the city. And so they didn't attack it. They just took all the money and took all the whatever they could get. And Jerusalem survived. That was looked at for 100 years, including in the time of Jeremiah. The temple of Yahweh, we did that last week, didn't we? The temple of Yahweh, that course Jerusalem could never fall to a foreign king, because Yahweh won't let it. He didn't let it in 701 and he won't let it now. That's their mentality, because God's running whoever wins wars in their view. So, in spite of that, now they've got to face up to the fact that the Babylonian army has razed Yahweh's city to the ground, or captured it in 598, and then it'll raise to the ground in the next 10 years. Despite assurances that God would guarantee the dynasty of David, and you've got plenty of Psalms saying that, haven't you? And the book of Samuel, your son will sit on the throne forever and ever, etc. Well, there's no king on the throne. There's someone appointed from the Babylonians who's an uncle in the line, but not part of the dynasty. So, now, despite their belief that the temple was the house of God, Yahweh, it's been destroyed. It wasn't destroyed till 587. I'm lumping those two together. Any national institutional basis for their religious identity had been swept away. If they were going to retain any sense of themselves as a people, they had to discover a firmer basis for who we are. Now, don't all cheer or shout or do anything. Just imagine Syria landed a bomb on Rome in the middle of a synod with all the bishops there. And the whole lot of them went. Well, that's what you're not supposed to be saying. No. So anyhow, something's happened to them. You get the feel of it. Who are we? What's happening? They've lost their land. They've lost their king. They've lost their temple. They're lost. So they've got to either give it up, which presumably most of them did, or search for something deeper. They had to learn a new humility and find a deeper faith in God that was independent of political and economic success. So it's a wonderful time for them, actually, as it works out. In Babylon, they found themselves living in what was in many ways a superior culture. Much more world-wise, and mathematics and science was already started there, and the language was a bigger language, and so on. The concept of monotheism, which we give mouth service to, that there's only one God, that concept, as distinct from what's technically called monolatry, from the Greek word to worship, which is, yes, there are many gods, of course. There's the god of Babylon, there's the gods of Egypt. This was the general understanding in Israel. But the only God that we can worship is Yahweh. Well, monotheism is a different idea. Monotheism is that there aren't any other gods. There is only one. Well, it began to emerge during the exile because of this shock. And you find it in Isaiah, which sadly we're not studying now, but in there you see the beginnings of a new idea, because when they went from their land, where they took everything for granted about the wonder of Yahweh, and they went to the Babylonian gods, which are surely now thought of as pretty powerful, because in a way they've beat Yahweh, do you get me? So they go, and then they find there's nothing there. They haven't got mountains. They've got his bloody statues. They've got eyes that cannot see, ears that cannot hear. Remember that from the... And the mouth that can't speak. What on earth are we dealing with? They had to have a man-made mountain. They had to make their own. Not the real ones, but they make... And that's the ziggurat. That's the Tower of Babel. Babylon, Babel. So it's a myth, of course. So the story is they have to build their own way up to heaven. We don't have to do that. We've got all these wonderful mountains, and God comes down on the mountain. Where's he going to come there? He's got to come down to a little man-made turret. Okay, so they began to wonder what is going on. And what is so for the first time they're starting to think, some of them, they're not really gods at all. Our God is the only God. Instead of identifying themselves now in relation to the Davidic dynasty, which there was always an argument about, right from the book of Samuel, when Samuel consecrated the first king, Saul, there's an argument. Should you or shouldn't you? And they're both in the Bible, because there was a debate. Was it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? It was partly good, partly bad. So you've got these two opinions fighting for dominance in the thing, and they're keeping them both there in the text because they're being honest. Well, now the Davidic dynasty's collapsed, so they had to see themselves as a community now identified by worship. Now, in the absence of the temple, which they haven't got in Babylon, and they're the key group, the people, because all the leaders, everyone who was anybody, 10,000 of them roughly, were taken into exile. The people left. Oh, they might have gone to the Sacré-Cœur nuns or something, to school, or Jesuits, I don't know what. But they were nobody, really. They're just out there in the paddocks trying to get potatoes and things going, but they hadn't thought much. So everyone who's anybody, the educators, the craftsmen, the artisans, the generals, the king and his, they're all in exile. So that's, in a way, the thinking group, the key group, and they're experiencing exile. They had to come together to remember who they were and to pray. And this is the beginning of the institution of the synagogue. Synagoge in Latin means coming together, drawn together. Ecclesia in Latin is called together. They're very similar kind of words. And in fact, ecclesia is the frequent Latin, Greek, Latin and Latin, translation of the synagogue, which is a Greek word now that I've got myself all confused, but forgive me. So, it's the beginning of the synagogue, which has remained central to Judaism ever since, as you know. They had to ask themselves how the loss of the land and the temple and the monarchy, how did it happen? And please pardon me if I keep saying this to you, in their mentality, they had to find a reason in human behaviour, because God did it. See, there's the assumption. God did it. God is just. So the fault can't be in God. We must have done something wrong. What was it? That's their question. It was impossible for them to contemplate the possibility that their God, Yahweh, was weaker than the God of Babylonians. So they concluded it must have been their God who brought about the catastrophe that they were experiencing. And since God is just, the problem had to be their infidelity to their part of the covenant. And they interpreted their loss and their suffering as God's punishment for their sin and as God's way of purifying them. Where had they gone wrong? What must they do to bring about the purification without which they couldn't enjoy God's blessing? These are some of the questions being asked by a number of different schools, I'll call them that, during the long years of exile. We're left to imagine, and this is how I imagine it anyhow, the dialogue, the debate, the discussion. They'd come together in their synagogue, or the rabbis would meet on their own somewhere, the intellectuals with their scrolls, and they'd debate and argue, and there'd be different schools of opinion as to what was wrong and what went, and this, you've got to, that's easy enough to imagine. Well, imagine it, as they struggled to find sense. So, a number of the schools that we know about in exile. A big school is the Deuteronomic school. It's been a long time in the making. This is the book of Deuteronomy, but it's much more than that. The book of Deuteronomy probably began in the northern kingdom before the destruction of Samaria in 721. So the middle, when literature starts in Israel, the time of Amos and Hosea, that period. So that's the beginnings of this spiritual look at who we are. When it was brought down to Jerusalem with the refugees in 721, it started a similar movement there, which had to go underground during the monarchy of Manasseh because he was completely subservient to Assyria. And then with Josiah, it comes up, it's allowed to, and they did a lot to do with this Josiah reform in 621. So it's a century afterwards, something like that. So you've got this Deuteronomic school, and in exile, they're the ones that are going to be responsible for the writing of what we call, wrongly, their history. That is the book of Deuteronomy itself. Then there's Joshua, Judges, these are the two. Then the books of Samuel and the books of Kings. A massive amount of the Old Testament is from this school, and you know by the language and the terminology and all of that. That's, everyone understands that, and it's completely intact and all scholars agree with it. So they were working on a comprehensive history, and when they write the history, if you get a chance to read it in the book of Deuteronomy or in the book of Kings or Samuel, they criticize the kings for what they did wrong because they're the ones mainly responsible for what went wrong. Another school are the priestly school. It's a lay movement, the Deuteronomic movement. So the priestly school, what are they going to do? Normally, they're busy at the temple, taking their turn to the sacrifices and doing this. There's no temple. Great. It's like a big holiday, really. So they're sitting, but they've got a problem. They've got the problem that they can't train the next lot of priests. They didn't learn by reading, they learned by watching and doing and all that kind of thing. So now, this is where you start to get written down what the priest does, the books of the Torah mainly, but especially Leviticus, which has got all the sacrifices and all the things happen. Of course you've got to write it down because you're not doing it, and it could be forgotten. When that generation dies out, it's gone. So it's all written down there, written during the exile by this priestly school. Concerned with the cult. Okay. Now, Ezekiel was a priest. He may have been part of this priestly school. I can't see why he wouldn't have been. So I imagine him with them, because the last nine chapters of, which we're not going to do today or ever with you, you just read them. They are his plan, perhaps the priestly school's plan, but it's in Ezekiel, for when the temple comes back, what we're going to do. Reforming the liturgy, new words, with your spirit instead of with you. That's what they're kind of getting that all organised. Another big school, which I haven't got time to talk about here, would be the Isaiah school, which is responsible for that beautiful literature, which we sometimes call Second Isaiah. I don't think it's a very good term for it. And the scholarship used to talk about an anonymous prophet who was responsible for chapter 40 to 55 of the scroll of Isaiah. I think that's unlikely. I think it's a school writing it, and the school are probably the the temple singers, the people responsible for the Psalms, because if you read 2nd Isaiah, so-called, it's where you're reading the Psalms. It's the same kind of music and beauty and so on that you find in the Psalms. So they're also working away. And in the middle of all that, you've got this priest, Ezekiel, the prophet. Right. So in 593, the priest-prophet Ezekiel began his prophetic career. He and this is a statement from Gottwald, one of the American scholars, he guided responsive exiles beyond arrogance or despair to recognition of their shame and guilt, and finally to repentance, all the while instructing them in the content of Yahweh's teaching about the morality, just and ritually proper life. So whatever their assumptions were, the good part of it all is they took the occasion to look at their faith. What do we believe in? Do we believe in the institution? Do we believe in God? Do we believe in the monarchy? You know, the hierarchy, if you like? Or do we believe in the surprise and the mystery of God's presence among us? You know, and they're not contradictory, those two things, but obviously the most fundamental thing is, do we really believe in God? That's the big question. And if so, what kind of a God? So they're talking about that. In 588, Zedekiah, who was appointed as governor of Judah in the absence, he was persuaded by a more aggressive Egyptian ruler to join the anti-Babylonian forces. Stupidly. And Jeremiah was the one who kept telling him we'd done that, not to. This led to the siege and destruction of Jerusalem in 587 and a second smaller deportation, smaller because there was hardly anybody left, of remaining leaders. Jeremiah gives the number as 832. So they took the next level off into exile. There's not much left. There's plenty of people left, but no organization left. Ezekiel writes, at the beginning of the siege, he talks about that, he talks about the fall of the city, nowhere talked about more explicitly than Ezekiel, because he's not living through it, but he's getting all the information about it, because he's in exile, and he indicates that the Jews in exile had some measure of communal life in the deportation camps. You've got to imagine they weren't on their own. There are also a lot of other people coming from different places. So it's a multicultural refugee situation they're in. But they weren't tormented or anything, and they weren't slaves. So they were pretty intelligent. They all wanted to survive. So they kind of sorted themselves out into their communities. And I suppose they then, I haven't got it there, but they also had to become more aware of who are we as Jews? Because now they're mixing with people who aren't Jews. So they started to define themselves now by what was different about them. And that's got memories for me of Catholicism after the Reformation. And what do we do that the others don't do? And I don't mean the deepest things like the Eucharist and so on, but Catholics don't eat meat on Friday, you know, that kind of thing. Catholics go to Mass every Sunday. Those things that identified us as Protestants eat meat, but we don't, you know. And there's nothing wrong with them. They were they identified themselves as circumcised, because not all the peoples around them were circumcised. Some of them were, some of them weren't. And their rituals, what they could eat became very important. We can't eat this food. The others do, but we can't. So they knew who they were. And also the sacrifices, it's all theoretical because they've got no temple that they worship. So offered to God. So they started to define themselves by not really the essentials, but the things that made them look different and feel different. Now, we're just about ready to get launched, not quite. Most of the first 24 chapters of the book of Ezekiel, that is, prior to the destruction of Jerusalem, so from the year 593 to 587, that 6-year period, most of chapters 1 to 24 consists in declarations of the divine punishment. Because they've got through the shock of this. And Ezekiel's saying, it's going to get worse if you don't. It did get worse. The city was destroyed. So because of the people's infidelity. And now when we add to from chapter 1 to 24, chapters 25 to 32 and 35 to 39, which consist in the divine punishment of other nations, it becomes clear that the largest part of Ezekiel's scroll, and it's the same for Jeremiah, is about anger, punishment, destruction, and we better change or else. It's fair enough, but that's what it's about. Yet in the middle of all that, Ezekiel has this. Have I any, from God, I have, from his prayer, have I any pleasure in the death of the wicked, says the Lord Yahweh? And not rather that they should turn from their ways and live? Cast away all your transgressions that you've committed against me, and get yourselves a new heart and a new spirit. Why will you die, O house of Israel? So it's good to hear that in the middle of all this. It's kind of thinking God's going to do all this dreadful stuff to you, but it's making it very clear God doesn't want to do it. He just has to do it because you're not behaving yourselves. But God is reluctant to do it, as Ezekiel sees it. Ezekiel has a lot to offer those of us who are in positions of leadership. He's devastating in his criticism of bad leaders who look after themselves and neglect those they're supposed to care for. Leaders are the easiest ones to knock, of course. I suppose if you're in a parish, the parish priest is pretty easy to knock, really. And if you're a priest, the bishop is pretty easy to knock, really. And if you're a bishop, the cardinal is a pain in the water, you know. And if you're a cardinal, you know, like, well, you know that by any institution. Unfortunately, when it's hierarchical, so we shouldn't waste time criticising. I don't think it's worth. We shouldn't criticise too much going up the ladder, if that's what you mean. We've got to do what we've got to do and do it honestly. And if we do it honestly, maybe they're going to listen. Maybe they won't. But let's do what we do. But anyhow, Ezekiel has a go at anyone in leadership. And see his declaration of the shepherds, the bad shepherds in chapter 34. He keeps promising God is not going to abandon his sheep. I'll just read you the text. I myself will search for my sheep. Okay, the kings let you down, the politicians have let you down in his world, the leaders have let you down, the big rich people have let you down, but I won't. I'll search for my sheep and I'll seek them out, says God. I'll break the bars of their yoke and I'll save them from the hands of those who've enslaved them. So Ezekiel criticizes the priests and especially those who claim to speak for God, but, quote, who follow their own spirit and have seen nothing. Very like Jeremiah there, isn't he? Jeremiah. I didn't send them, but they ran. I didn't ask them to prophesy, but they're prophesying, the false prophets. Well, here, the priests, what are they doing? They're following their own spirit, but they can't see anything. They see a cracked wall, says Ezekiel, quite a powerful image, and the wall's cracked, and you're selling the house, you see. So you slap something over the top of it and paint it. It looks beautiful. There's a bloody crack about an inch thick under the paint, which is only discovered by the people after it's been bought. Well, that's what they're doing. The system's cracking everywhere, and they're plastering it over it, with making it look okay. Whitewashing it. They prophesy out of their own imagination. Ezekiel himself is instructed to eat God's word. Just take it in, chew it, mastigate it, you know, is that the word? Yeah, and kind of get it into the system and then speak. And he's told to receive it in your heart and to speak then whether the people listen or don't listen. Dotted throughout the scroll, especially in the chapters that post-date the fall of Jerusalem, which we'll do also today, God willing, from chapter 33 to 39, before we move into the plan for the next temple, we find a promise of restoration. So once the worst has happened, so he's building up to the destruction of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem's then destroyed, well, the threats happened, the punishments happened, it can't get worse. Well, thank God, after that, most of his words are going to be encouraging. because we've got to the bottom. Now there's got to be hope, and he wants it. So there's a promise of restoration and of covenant, a covenant that this time will last forever. Though Yahweh must punish, as he sees it, his will is, quote, that they will be my people and I'll be their God. So God hasn't given up on them. Quote, as chapter 6, I will establish my covenant with you, and you'll know that I am Yahweh, in order that you may remember and be confounded and never open your mouth again because of your shame, when I forgive you all that you've done, says the Lord Yahweh. Yahweh wants to re-establish the loving communion he offered when Israel first became his people. And that for that to happen, they'll need a new spirit. So here we are, chapter 11. I'll give them one heart. I'll put a new spirit in them. I'll remove the heart of stone from their flesh, and I'll give them a heart of flesh, so that they may follow my statutes and keep my ordinances to obey them. They will be my people and I'll be their God. So they'll take it in and live from inside, not just following the Torah because it's out there. This text seems to make this gift dependent on repentance. Elsewhere, the gift is presented as wholly a divine initiative flowing from God's largesse. And to complete the introduction, Ezekiel uses extraordinary imagery to express his experience of his initial encounter with God. And if you've read chapter 1, it's wheels and fire and seraphim, and it's psychedelic stuff. Spirit and fire. The destruction of the temple doesn't end God's presence with his people. That's his key message, and it's a wonderful one. The temple's destroyed. God's left the temple. God's left us? No. In the book of Ezekiel, the chariot, this fiery chariot, comes out of the temple, rests upon the hill of Olives, the Mount of Olives, and then comes in. Well, it comes right in chapter 1. But that's presence, that God is moving to go where his people are. So God is with you here in exile. Don't be hearkening back to, we can't go to the temple, so we can't be with God. No, God's come with you. It's quite beautiful, really. So the glorious and always transcendent and mysterious Yahweh, and it's very transcendent and mysterious in Ezekiel, is, quote, a sanctuary for them in the countries where they have gone. This is surely a consoling message for all of us, whatever state we find ourselves in.